saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Maximum Film. This is episode 289, and I don't rhyme. Damn it!
No!
All right, I'm filling in for Hollywood's favorite muscly nerd, Iffy Wadaway, who is off to parts unknown, literally unknown. I cannot keep up with him. He will return someday, but not today. Today, it is all me. I am, of course, thankful that in the non-booth with me is everyone's favorite critic, I've been informed, America's best film critic, other than maybe other people who've been on this show, but certainly up there, Alonzo Duralde, what's good?
Andrea, my what's good is actually kind of on your behalf. I think what's good is that two really great seasons of television just wrapped up in the last week, which means that now you get to start watching them, because I know you have this thing about binging complete seasons rather than having to get strung along on a week-to-week basis the way that serialized writers of content would like you to be. So you now have to look forward to season one of Poker Face and season one of The Last of Us, both of which are dynamite and both of which capped off in the last few days. So now you have no excuse not to be digging in.
Girl, I watched all of Poker Face in a day and a half.
Nice.
Like intended. And I love it so much. And I would watch an episode of Poker Face every day for the rest of my life. If given the chance, I probably will not be given the chance. But it also made me very happy I waited, because I was super excited when each episode ended and I had another hot little episode waiting
nice,
for me.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay, so in the absence of Iffy and with the excitement over today's film, we could not settle for just a singular guest. We needed a duo of monstrous proportions, monstrous in the best way, obviously, how everybody uses the word monstrous, highly illustrious, highly knowledgeable, and both return buddies. The hosts of Unspooled, that's right, Amy Nicholson and Paul Scheer. Amy, we shall begin with you. What is good?
Oh, man. Well, the thing that's happening this week that I've been really looking forward to is I'm going to start taking transcendental meditation classes.
Ooh.
I'm very excited about this. Paul inspired me. Paul and my beloved best friend Eva and my beloved boyfriend, they all do TM. And so later today I have to go and gather three things to bring to my first session. You're supposed to bring a white handkerchief, some fruit, and some flowers. It sounds a little culty, but in a good way. I'm stoked. I feel like very LA now. Paul, is that fair? Oh, no, Paul's grimacing. Now I feel like I screwed up and I'm already on TM's bad side.
Those mantras don't come cheap.
They don't come cheap. Oh, my goodness.
Is it Rick Rubin that got super into, it changed his life as a producer?
Oh, is it? Really?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm a Lynch girl. Lynch is my
way. David Lynch is a fan. I knew that one.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. That tracks. I love it.
But it wouldn't surprise me about Rubin. It wouldn't surprise me about a lot of creative people.
No, it wouldn't.
From what I hear, it's like I feel like I have 90,000 thoughts running through my head at any time. I'd like to have one or two that I can really just focus on. That's what I'm hoping. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting my hopes up too high. But
I can't wait for you to be transcended by Wednesday. That's how it works, right? Very quickly. Yeah. Yeah.
Very quickly. Very quickly. What I love about Tim is they just keep saying it's the easy one without a lot of stress. They're like, we're not the stressful meditation. We don't make it hard. And that's great.
Oh, my God. I love it. Paul Scheer, welcome back. And what is good with you?
What is good is that I did not invest in the Silicon Valley Bank. I have no money in that. I feel really good about that. I feel like I avoided crypto art, and now I've avoided this. I feel like I'm doing a good job here of not getting caught up.
I'm very proud for you and your portfolio.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I hope you have one and mention it a lot.
I'm often talking about my portfolio and about my assets and about my health insurance. My voice is shot, and it's sadly not because of partying. It's because of allergies. So, I don't know what else to tell you, but this is the voice you're going to get. But I'll tell you this much. That Rick Rubin book that he just wrote is phenomenal. And truly, I think another life-changing book. I've read a couple of books that just kind of blew me away on a very big way. And Rick Rubin's book was just amazing about creativity and how to tackle just working together and allowing yourself to basically create without any barriers and think outside of the box. It's a really beautiful book. And it sounds like, oh, I've read a million of these things, but it's also Rick Rubin, and his experience level is incredibly different. And I think in a weird way, it's like he's pulled in a lot of different things, and he's just kind of giving you his outlook on these. You know, it's not like he's not being prescriptive. He's saying, this is how I do this. And so it's really kind of fascinating.
Amy, I'm getting a sense of how Paul nudged you into this. I just heard that and I was like, okay, I'm definitely going to check my Libby app and see if the creative act, a way of being, thank you, Marissa, is avail.
Well, now I just want to figure out a way to inspire Rick Rubin so we can come full circle. So we can be a circle of inspiration. Otherwise, I'm just at the bottom. Nobody's inspired by me. My cat doesn't even respect me. This is really low.
That's a solid life goal. What did you do? I've inspired Rick Rubin and you.
And my cat.
And did I mention my sweet portfolio?
So many assets. Yeah.
Drea, what's good?
Yeah. What's good with me is a leapfrog on what was good with me last week. So for anyone who didn't hear that, I had a very lovely thing where my sweet boys, the Daniels, gave me a very lovely shout out from stage from the Spirit Awards and a thank you while they were accepting Best Director. And undoubtedly, we will be discussing the Oscars today, so they may come up again. But my what's good was the culmination of like this beautiful week of people seeing the video of them talking about me from stage, and then other filmmakers I've programmed reaching out and just touching base or thanking me themselves. Like, it's been like, oh, nice. I got to attend my own funeral, basically. If only everyone got that. But then the beautiful button on all of it was at the Oscars last night, when I got the most dad text of dad text from my dad, which was, what'd you do in the last week? They didn't say your name once this time.
Oh, I was like, man.
Awesome. Way to dad.
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't kind of waiting for a repeat, you know, but I understood.
It was absurd enough. They said it like five times the first time. I was certainly not expecting it again, but it was very like within seconds, old Dick Clark in my phone. Oh, what'd you do? Hollywood's pretty fickle, huh?
Well, like, I got to say, I was upset as well that Daniels did not call me out because I believe I gave them their first ever TV directing gig.
Oh, that's awesome. Really? Yeah. I did not do that.
Yeah. They directed two episodes of NTSF SDSUV. They might have directed Children's Hospital before that, or I can't remember if it was the same time or not, because we met with them and we said, all right, come up with a promo idea. Here's the amount of money that we have, whatever you want to do. And it's one of my favorite promos. You can see it online if you just type in like NTSF guns. I think that's what will pop up, because basically what we do is we spell out the name of the show by shooting bullets in a wall. And it's NTSF SDSUV. And then we go, and it's a bigger joke. Well, that's the beginning of the joke. But it's so beautifully shot, and it was really great. I'm like, oh, we got to get these guys to actually like direct episodes. And they directed like one of my favorite episodes of NTSF that we did, called Comic-Con Air, where a bunch of Comic-Con villains were being transported to a different prison, and they plan an escape. And Joe Latrulio's in it, and Poker Face, Natasha Lyonne is in it. A bunch of great people, Summer Glau, but it's a Daniels directed episode.
So y'all are both FOTD, friends of the Daniels.
Yeah. I'm responsible for every single thing they've done, basically between Paul and I.
This is it.
Yeah, certainly. All right. Well, now that we know what is good, we can move on, because we have a lot more good ahead of us with today's show. We are entering the ring with Creed 3, which is a boxing term, everybody. Sports. Later, we will have a quiz about actor-directors. But first, it is time for It a Dick, which is our movie news segment. Is this important? Do I care? And we're going to ask ourselves both of those questions with the following movie news. Alonso, kick us off.
So Tommy Wiseau's infamous indie The Room turns 20 years old this year, which makes me feel old because I was an early adopter. And to celebrate, the world's most famous terrible movie is getting a remake. Bob Odenkirk will star in the lead role originally played by Wiseau, speaking of actor-directors, but word is he's going to play it straight. This isn't your average Hollywood cash grab, though. It's for charity. The film will mostly be shot on green screen, and profits will support the Foundation for AIDS Research. Is this important? Do you care?
I do like this casting. Amy?
Well, I want to kick this to Paul, actually, because Paul is the biggest champion of The Room that I have ever met, besides you, of course, Alonzo. I feel like today we've got to give everybody's flowers. but my immediate beat is, it seems impossible. It just seems impossible for a good actor to be a bad actor of that caliber and not be too much into the joke.
Well,
but I love the challenge. I mean, to me, like, doing Tommy Wiseau is kind of up there with doing Hamlet. You know, like, only the rare birds are going to be able to accomplish this.
You know,
but Paul, you, this means the most to me.
Well,
I mean, this means the most to you. That was a really big flub.
Well, no.
This means a lot to
you.
Yeah,
well, look, I was in The Disaster Artist, which I think did a great job at capturing what was interesting about The Room. My issue with this has nothing to do with Bob. And first of all, if it's for charity, I care about it. It's great. Let's give people money. People will tune in. I'll tune in to see. I think what's interesting about The Room is The Room. And so when you start to like go like, well, what if it was like this or that? Well, it ceases to become that. Like, why we like it. It's not like, oh, it would be so interesting to see his spin on dialogue. Like, there's a difference where if you do like Triangle of Sadness with a different cast, okay, that's interesting. I saw American Beauty done with Adam Driver as the Wes Bentley role and Bryan Cranston as the Kevin Spacey role. That was interesting. I don't know if it worked, but it was interesting. Like, and this, I don't think you're going to have like that. It won't be like, oh, wow, the dialogue actually is really good. Like, I'm a big fan of this. I don't believe that anyone should sing a full karaoke song. I feel like every karaoke song should be 90 seconds long because that's about
just the hook.
That's about all that we need from everybody. We don't need it. Like, so give me a highlight reel of this because I don't need to watch 90 minutes of that. I don't need to watch 90 minutes of you on a green screen doing this thing. It just feels like, give me a little bit. I'll still pay the same amount and I'll be fulfilled instead of bored and then turning it off.
Yeah.
Wait, but I like this challenge you're setting up. You know, because people always have that line like, why do we only remake Hollywood's best movies? Why don't we remake Hollywood's bad movies and try to make them good?
Yeah.
If there's a gauntlet thrown of, can you take The Room and turn it into Hamlet?
Well, but that's
I don't
different.
Think that's the goal here. I think they want to make a cover version, essentially.
Right. And that to me feels like my whole thing is, I agree with you, Amy. It's like, I'm like, remake Logan's Run. Great premise, executed mildly, well, badly or mediocrely.
Spottily,
like,
let's say.
Yes, spottily, right. And like, but here it's like, they're just going to be doing the lines. And he's also like, I think Greg Sestero's in it with him. It's like they're bringing back certain actors from The Room. So it's like, what are we doing? Like it's a good idea on paper, and I feel like it's going to be a tougher idea to execute, in my opinion.
I also kind of think it's time to let The Room go. I think it's brought us a lot of joy, but it's like that joke isn't funny anymore, as the Smiths would say. And I don't know. I kind of feel like it's sort of played out. And I think The Disaster Artist was sort of like the pinnacle of Room homage / commentary / whatever. And I don't know that there's anything left to cull from that particular corpse, you know.
Well, to me, it's like, yeah, watch the original. That's it. It's never going away.
Yeah. And you're right. It's you can't sort of do a bit on the original because the point of the original is the original. And like it, unless you're going to go full bar for like, okay, I'm turning it into an opera or something. I think as another movie, it's like you're not going to capture the crazy magic that is that original. You know, if you wanted to go in and remake like After Last Season, which is an equally bonkers movie that only a fraction of people have seen compared to The Room, then I think that would be bringing something new to the table. But I don't know what there is left to do here, especially if you're just kind of doing a sort of sideways homage parody reenaction.
This falls into the category to me where we got in COVID where it was like, we're just going to do a bunch of live table reads. Mm. Live table reads as an actor are the worst part of the job. They're the, like, they are boring by nature, right? So it's like, what can we do to make it interesting? Like, let's change it. Let's break the mold a little bit. But this just seems like, it does feel like it falls in that same thing. It's like, we know what we're expecting. It just feels like it's going to be, I don't know, just unless, I don't know. But look, will I pay for it? Absolutely, because I love charity. Well, now let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Would you be interested in seeing Tommy Wiseau do The Godfather?
Yes.
I would.
Or the last season of Better Call Saul.
Hey, there you go.
I'd like to see Tommy Wiseau do My Best Friend's Wedding as Julia Roberts' character.
Yes.
If we're picking what we'd like to see him in, that's where I'm going.
Well, and maybe he will win an Academy Award for doing that. And speaking of which, we are recording this the day after the Academy Awards broadcast. So hopefully our hot takes will not be ice cold by the time you hear this episode. But the Oscars does mark certainly the end of award season and in a way the unofficial close of the movie year. So let's take a minute to talk about the Oscars. And of course, in the context of, was it important and do we care?
Oh, nice. You work that back in. Our catchphrase, it's catching on. There was a really, I mean, obviously everyone here, best friends with the Daniels. So very psyched there. I'm not going to lie. Like midway through, I generally am pretty good at guessing. Like actually many people in this town who are well aware of just guild votes are. It's not a secret. It's one of the best ways to know which areas are going to go. But I was like, is All Quiet sneaking in? This what?
Oh, no.
I was so, because I also did not like All Quiet on the Western Front. Like I really liked the first version, the book. Like anyway, I was very like, oh, I don't even know if the regular viewer is aware that an element of tension was actually added, because it was so kind of blasé about like, oh, for sure, Everything Everywhere is going to win. So the fact that I actually was concerned about it, I was like, oh, unexpected. Don't like it, but unexpected.
It was stressful. I was like ready to fight World War III if like the Germans kept sweeping more awards. And I don't know how inside guildy awardy this is, but like, Alonzo, as members of LAFCA, I was really surprised by like this rise of interest for All Quiet, because it didn't make any dent in LAFCA. We didn't talk about it at all. They didn't even flog it to us that I was really aware of.
Yeah,
it just sort of appeared and was like, what is this dark horse that's dominating everything?
So right, it was winning the BAFTAs and everything. And yeah, it did sort of kind of come out of nowhere. And, you know, part of what we talk about, the sort of the new Academy of the last few years, it's not just that the membership is younger and more, you know, still involved in the industry, but also very international. You know, that's like how Parasite won Best Picture. And so I thought maybe there is like a strong Euro contingent that's going to sweep in and make All Quiet happen. It's interesting that this year was dominated by A24 and Netflix. I mean, A24 has had a Best Picture winner before, obviously, with Moonlight. But like, they were they pretty much took the lion's share of everything this year. And you know, the fact that A24 is the first studio in history to win like the top six slots, and you know, there was a lot of interesting records last year. It was like the first Asian woman to win, or first Asian woman to
Asian identified. Well,
yeah, that, exactly. Which because Merle Oberon was being quiet about it, but yeah, first Asian woman to win Best Actress. First time Indies won Best Actor and Actress since like William Hurt and Geraldine Page back in the 80s. Only the third movie to win like three acting prizes and Best Picture, and only the third Best Picture to win both supporting actor and actress. Anyway, who would have thought a year ago when this movie premiered at South by Southwest that this would be the movie that would burn down the Oscars? Like, I am shocked. I'm delighted. I love that movie, and I just never in a million years would have predicted it.
Do you think that the landscape of theaters, or like what was out in theaters, actually helped that movie get to the front of the line? Because we're talking about a time a year ago, or a little bit over a year ago, or less than a year ago, I should say, where the theater, there wasn't that many movies out, like, and one film could actually stay around. When I was a kid, I remember that a movie could come out like third or fourth and work its way up to first because of word of mouth, yeah, right? And I feel like because there are only three or four movies in the theater, there are fewer choices and people want to go see it. And one of the cool things about that movie is it's not traditional Oscar bait movie. It's a sci-fi comedy. It has a different cast. You know, it's not a full white movie, you know, in that way. So I think it
has dildos. I thought you were going with dildos rather than different casts. But sure.
You know, but I mean, so I think it kind of hit all these things in a way that felt elevated and artistic, like Academy Award movies do feel, but it actually did cross over that line of being something that people actually saw. And of course, you're always going to get Avatar, which is something that people saw. And Maverick, I was happy that that got in there. I'm still bummed, a little bit burned, that RRR was not in the best top 10.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a tremendous oversight for what it was. Like when I look at the scope of movies this year, I am still bummed that like Mia Goth didn't get nominated for Best Actress. But I do believe that if there was a male actor up for Best Actor from Everywhere, Everything, All at Once, he would have won as well. Because it was that kind of a year. It was just like, we're going to go all in on this. The only thing I got nervous about last night was that Lady Gaga might have had more name recognition. And going back to All Quiet on the Western Front, I believe that that, to a certain audience that's making these votes, go, oh, All Quiet on the Western Front, I know that. That's a classic book. I'm going to vote for that. Like, that's why I kind of felt that like Austin Butler might win for Elvis. It's like, oh, no, that's, I understand Elvis. That's something. But there were some interesting choices all the way around.
Well, what scared me about it, though, was like when the All Quiet vote started marshalling up, it suddenly felt like we were fighting a battle that I was really hoping would be settled this year, which is what is an Oscar movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, to me, Everything Everywhere being up there, being the top dog for Best Picture, it felt like the first film of my generation, you know, that was up there to be like a top prize contender, something with a sense of humor that fits me. Because we've had some young directors sort of win, like Nomadland, but Nomadland didn't feel like a film representing our generation, representing a new style of filmmaking, a new sense of humor, a new sensibility, a new sense of interests. And then suddenly, All Quiet, which feels so old-fashioned, you know, so old-fashioned marshalling up, it felt like the old guard was just like creeping up to grab us and drag us back into like this boomery, serious, solemn war film tenure that has like cast a shadow over my entire life as a movie lover.
That's a movie that I think a lot of Oscar pundits wanted to see win because that's a safe atmosphere that they know how to work in. You know,
well,
there's a nice trajectory in terms of what is the new Oscar. So it will be interesting to see where it goes next year. And it does start with Chloe Zhao's Nomadland and Sean Hader's Coda last year. Like they're both young directors as well.
But those films are so fussy.
They have different intents, mm-hmm. but there is something. Anyway, we could do this forever, and alas, we will not. I do agree. I will let Amy end that on. They are so fussy. I'll give her that last. And we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jonathan Majors and Michael B. Jordan go toe-to-toe in Creed 3.
Maximum Film is supported in part by MasterClass. With MasterClass, you can learn from the world's best minds anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. Explore the 10 to 15 minute lessons in any order you'd like across your phone, tablet, Apple TV, and computer.
All right. I know every time we talk about MasterClass, I like to overtake things. And it's because I am super interested in lifelong learning. And MasterClass is a great platform to figure that out. I have definitely spoken in the past about courses that range from everything from like negotiation tactics and wellness, but filmmaking is my heart and soul, and I don't talk about it enough, and the classes are fantastic. The one I would currently recommend, Werner Herzog Teaching Filmmaking. And it's not just, I mean, it's nuts and bolts, it's ethos, it's shooting, picking locations, how to negotiate, how to get financing, how to build a story, editing, all of it. He gets into the whole frame, and he, of course, has a background in both narrative and documentary work. It's almost 6 hours with him. Anyway, I think there's so many great courses you can check out, and they're broken into smaller lessons, so you can do them a bit at a time. But Werner Herzog, that's my vote for this time.
Check it out today. Get unlimited access to every class, and as a Maximum Fun listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/maxfilm now. That's masterclass.com/maxfilm for 15% off Masterclass.
All right, welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host this week, Drea Clark, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Amy Nicholson.
Paul Scheer.
Today's movie tells the continuing saga of Adonis Creed, as played by Michael B. Jordan, who also directed the film, his first time as a helmer. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis?
Sure. Adonis Creed begins the film winning what is supposed to be his farewell to boxing and retiring as the heavyweight champ so that he can spend more time with his wife, Bianca, played by Tessa Thompson, and his daughter, Amara, played by Mila Davis-Kent. But wouldn't you know it, from his past comes a guy named Damien, played by Jonathan Majors. When they were teenagers, Adonis was his corner man. Damien was a Golden Gloves champion and, you know, seemingly on the precipice of boxing fame. And then because of things that occurred between them, Damien goes to jail and Adonis continues down the path of boxing stardom. Now Damien wants to pick up where he left off with Adonis's help. And what seems to be a gesture between two old friends soon turns into something much more nefarious that will bring Adonis back into the Creed. Adonis Creed back into the ring, rather, to stop Dame on his pursuit of taking the belt away from Adonis. That's Creed 3.
Yeah, you did it. All right, this is the third Creed movie, but it's also the ninth Rocky movie, although notably minus a Rocky. However, it's still that world. Where does everyone stand with this franchise? What's your background? Do you have any particular affinity to it? And then how did you see Creed fitting into or kind of breaking the mold?
Well, I can go first and just say that growing up, Rocky was just a part of the movie landscape. You know, Stallone was known for Rocky, and these films, at least for me, were on HBO all the time. So I felt like I saw Rocky 3 and Rocky 4 a million times. I remember being in the theater and being disappointed by Rocky 5, which was depressing and weird, and Tommy Gunn and all this bizarre stuff. It was like the high that we reached of Rocky 4 takes a crashing low as we deal with his brain condition, which I guess is real, but also just a mess. I didn't really have that much connection to Rocky 1 or Rocky 2. So I was definitely living in the 80s Rocky. When I saw Creed, I was excited because I like Michael B. Jordan. I love Ryan Coogler. I was like, this is an interesting idea. I love the idea that Coogler came to Stallone before, you know, Fruitvale and was like, I want to do this. It was like a passion project. And I loved it. I was like, Creed, this movie is great. It's like a beautiful passing of the torch. I think we talk a lot, or we have talked a lot this year about like Maverick and how like that was a great idea of a sequel and a reboot. And then Creed 2 comes. And Creed 2 to me feels like Rocky Devon or Rocky 8 or wherever we are. Oh yeah, Rocky 8, right? Because there's Rocky Balboa after Rocky 5. Right, yeah. So feels like Rocky 8. And I was like, no. I like these characters. We're going in this direction. Then we go back to Rocky. It was like, you didn't learn anything. And that's Stallone getting his hand on the script, starting to get in there. You have a less assured director, and no offense to that director, but it's not Coogler. And then it was a bummer. But then to see that Michael B. Jordan was doing this, I was a little hesitant at first, like, oh, I didn't really love Rocky 2. I mean, Creed 2. And then Creed 3, I'll just say this and I'll throw it to all you all. Creed 3 was like, oh, this is the Creed sequel that we were promised. This is the world that we're going into. Finally, the torch has been passed. This is a continuation of a franchise without it being a sequel. And I loved it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Passion.
I feel the same way about Stallone's chokehold on this franchise. Like, he's got it against the ropes and he's holding his neck and the referee is not being like, dude, yeah, let go. like, Paul knows that I have my gripes with the first Creed, that I feel like as soon as Stallone starts being like, cough, cough, I'm sick, the movie just, like, to me, goes really off the rails, and, like, it stops even caring about Michael B. Jordan. Same thing with Creed 2. As much as I love Dolph Lundgren, I'm so happy to see Bridget Nielsen show up again. I love these little bits, but Creed 3 might be my favorite Creed because it is so Creed-centric, even though I have gigantic quibbles with this, which is that I almost think Jonathan Majors is too good for this movie. He's so good in this movie that I think he throws the entire universe of this movie off balance, you know?
Yep.
But the highs of this movie are fantastic. Like, everything up until, like, the last third, to me. Again, kind of like the first third. I guess to me, Creeds always go off the rails in the third act. But,
That's what Creeds are known
for. That's what they're known for, man. But I thought Michael B. Jordan actually did a great job as a director capturing the feel of the fights. I like the vibe of this. What I always struggle with, though, in this film is the idea of trying their absolute hardest, whatever they can, to make Creed the underdog, right? That's just, like, the problem here. Like, it starts with Creed being like, I'm super rich now. Look at my giant mansion. I can afford a room that's only for my trophies and a giant picture of me and my own abs. And yet somehow...
And a bottle of Hennessy. There's always a bottle of Hennessy.
But I'd argue that's actually one of the things that they were successful with entirely because of Jonathan Majors' star power. Like, you can't position this where Creed, who's this guy that we've been following the whole time, who has been on top of the world, who has my dream home. I was like, can we just go back to the house that they live in and just get the characters out of the way and now just walk the camera around real slow so I could take it all in? It's incredible views. But you see him, all of these things, and the idea of, oh, actually, the heart of what he brings as a fighter and as a man and as, like, a self-actualized human who could possibly get into a TM at some point. Who knows? But he, to me, I really liked that shaping, and I don't think that shaping would have been possible if you didn't have an absolutely combustible force like Jonathan Majors. Like, I don't see Adonis Creed being the underdog or whatever, and then you see
without
Dame,
a legit threat. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, oh no, that guy's the star. Oh, that guy's gonna whoop you. Like, you need that.
This is another I'm old moment, because I saw the first Rocky in the theaters when I was a kid and loved it. Like, it was, I know it's the movie that broke Hollywood, but at that age, what did I know? You know, so I loved all the sort of hokey old fashionedness of it. Ran out to see Rocky II, enjoyed that. Liked Rocky III okay. You know, that was early Mr. T and all. And so that was, you know, pretty awesome. I saw Rocky IV in college and was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Because the Cold War messaging in that movie couldn't be more, like, on the nose, up the nose, you know, and just overly done. And so then I bailed on the franchise after that. So it wasn't until Creed that I went back in to watch another Rocky movie. And I've enjoyed the franchise so far. And yeah, I could do with less Stallone, although I did think the son of Apollo Creed fights the son of Drago is an interesting way to do it. And the fact that son of Drago is, you know, not bad to look at in boxing trunks helped. But, you know, I've always sort of liked these movies. They're, you know, they're well done. It's Ryan Coogler for the first one, you know, but I haven't been fired up by them. And I think this one is pretty terrific. And I really admire a lot of the choices that Jordan is making in terms of how to shoot the fights and other stuff. My issue with it, it's not so much that the Jonathan Majors throws off the balance because he's so good. I mean, he's amazing in this. My problem is that, to me, Dame feels like a metaphor more than a character. Like, he is this representation of Adonis's, like, unresolved guilt about, you know, coming up from the streets and leaving other people behind, about, you know, police involvement, whatever. Like, I never got my hands on Dame as a person. He felt more like a concept, and that's with an actor as talented as Jonathan Majors playing. So anybody less than that, I think it would have been even more of a kind of cardboard stick figure for me. But there's a lot that I admire here, and I've enjoyed all three of these movies. I've never wanted to watch any of them a second time.
I mean,
the shorthand of Dame for me, is he's Killmonger from Black
Panther.
Yeah,
but Killmonger at least has a philosophy where you go, you know, you're the villain, but you're not entirely wrong. Whereas Dame is
That's what I felt with Dame, in the sense of, like, Yeah, man, that guy did not have it good. Does he definitely have a darkness to him from the beginning in terms of like when we find out about his youth and how he turns to violence immediately? Sure. But I found a nice complication that was reminiscent of Killmonger to me in that idea of, oh, the more he says, the more I'm like, yeah, I guess I'd be kind of pissed too. I mean, you didn't have it so great. And then you're watching this thing. I liked that I could identify with that. Amy, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. I stepped on you.
I kind of feel the same way. I feel like there's a couple Dame scenes towards the end that maybe they never wrote. Maybe they wrote and shot. Maybe they didn't put them in. But I felt like we needed a little more Dame towards the end. Because one of the moments that really hit me hard is like when you go back and you see the whole crime, I'm putting that in air quotes on purpose, play out that gets Jonathan Majors put in jail. You realize he took out a gun, he didn't fire it, he didn't shoot anybody. He got locked away that long because of three strikes law, you know, that we had here in California.
Right. Yeah.
And the pain of that, he didn't actually screw up. Like, it would almost be different if he had hurt somebody, if he had hurt somebody trying to protect Creed. He really just got fucked. And so nobody helping him, even Creed not helping him when he's like getting ready for that first fight, which I think is the best directed of them. You know, where he's like fighting that amazing guy who comes in like the wolf costume with all the smoke and the skeletons and everything. He's so alone. And I don't come back from how much I pity him, how much I feel sorry for him, that pain in his eyes. And so to me, when Creed's like, no, man, I'm the underdog, even though he's like, I'm younger, I've got an underwear model. Oh, I've got to really work out by pulling my own private plane. What?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm really the underdog. My name's in fireworks. You know, I don't come back from seeing Jonathan Majors alone in his apartment. Like, I'm mm-hmm. rooting for him. I'm just rooting for him. And like, maybe they, it feels like they tried to make him darker. Like in that fight, there's like some implication in the first one that he's like a cheater, I guess, but it seems a little unclear. Like, is he a cheater because he doesn't know the rules, or is he just straight up cheating? Whatever it is, he doesn't cheat in the big fight.
Right.
What's happening here?
Here's what I think about Rocky. And Amy and I were talking about this the other day. Rocky movies to me aren't boxing movies. And the reason why I feel this, and I know it's a hard thing to wrap your head around, but it's like the first Rocky movie is written by Stallone. He's not a boxer. He's not a boxing fan. He's telling a story, like an underdog story, right? People believing in him. I think what was so powerful about Creed was the story was about fathers and sons. And, you know, am I my father's son? Am I worthy of this? Who is my father? Am I like, and it ends in that moment, you know, one in the ring in Creed 1 where it's like, what do you want to tell your dad? You know, and it's like, and then it's like him and Rocky looking out at their future. Creed 2, take that all out. But Creed 3 to me was about brothers and who you are and who you want to be. And there's this interesting element, the way that we tell our story, where we ignore certain things, celebrities, like, oh, how did I get ahead here? What did I do? And we know Creed as this hero, the underdog, but everybody has a villain, probably, right? Everyone has this story here. And I think it was about kind of coming face to face with it. So to the point of like, oh, he's a concept. I get what you're saying with that. I think that Jonathan Majors is so good. It's the first time I've seen a film in recent memory that I wanted to stop multiple times and rewind because I was like, what is he doing? I can't, what is going on here? Like the way that he is introduced and the way that he changes from the beach scene to the ring, it's like he is doing this multifaceted character. And I almost think like his acting is so far ahead. I don't think it's bad writing. I almost think like his act, I think that like he's playing Creed. So it's like, here's a character that is manipulating Creed, but he's also this kind of bad guy. There's a lot of levels to him. And unfortunately, Michael B. Jordan, there isn't a lot of levels to him, Creed. And that's just a function of the script and what we have. So he is at an unfair advantage. Like, you know, I feel like it's this sort of, there's less show there. I think that's why the villains in Rocky are always better. It's like, what demon is he fighting? And that's the demon. And that's what I love about the fight scene at the end, that kind of, you know, anime inspired fight scene. Like it wasn't, who cares about the fight? It's about this, putting him in bars, the bed, like all that stuff to me made this movie like, so like that's to me when a Rocky movie works, not about the boxing. It's not about, oh, he learned how to punch him the right way. Like, you know, Rocky 3, for lack of a better term, it's like they taught Rocky how to like have like rhythm and move. You know, it's like, I mean, the undercurrent to me is like, we need to teach Rocky how to be black. I mean, that's like such, I mean, that was basically what that was, you know, and it's like, well, who cares about that? I want to hear about the story. Like, what's the story? Like, it's not about like, we watched Creed train in this movie and we don't like seem like, oh, you got to learn all this. It's like, no, you just have to like, who cares?
Basically, pull your own plane.
Yeah, pull your own.
You don't get to fly to Vegas this weekend. You just got to pull it across your own.
But it's weirdly like the weight of celebrity, the weight of his success he has to carry and then like carry it forward. I don't know.
Ooh, look at that.
That's deep, bro.
Anyway.
On that note, I love the moment where he's like arguing with Tessa Thompson earlier and in the movie, and they're like arguing in front of their in-home chef.
Yes.
Those little bits of mojo. They don't even seem to notice that the in-home chef is listening to
but
all
I'm
of
glad
it.
They include those. Like, again, this the house that I am obsessed with, even just shooting things there, it's like, oh, we're not going to pretend that he's not this absurd level of fame or wealth or whatever. Right. It's part of his character.
He drives by his own Ralph Lauren billboard on Sunset Boulevard.
The crux of Rocky is like my dad who likes to tease me over text. Rocky, one of his all-time favorite movies, and I think that movie, this franchise, and then it's interesting seeing Creed be the sort of modern interpretation. A lot of what these films do, men are not either well-equipped or sort of societally supported in terms of emotional excavation and vulnerability and self-actualization. And the Rocky movies, there's a vast history of sports films doing this, but they give an avenue for men to explore, why do I feel this way? Why am I having this relationship issue with this woman? Why with my father? Why with this brother? Like, and then they can talk. And then, you know, before it gets too soft, then they can also punch each other and bleed.
By the way,
it's a guy's movie.
Magic Mike XXL has done it too. I mean, like, you know, there's something really interesting about this like wave of this conversation. I think that like also they portrayed like who better to make a movie about being rich, famous, and successful than Michael B. Jordan. He's living the life of this character. It wasn't robots, like, you know, it was like that we saw in Rocky III, you know. It was, there's something about it where I was like,
the robot.
You know, it's like we're seeing a very clean representation of what it would be like to be the heavyweight champion and be as attractive as he is. I also felt, and not to like hammer this home, Michael B. Jordan is 36. I think he's probably like 35 in the film. I think that Creed is a little bit younger than actual Michael Jordan. Like, you need to give him a reason to get back in the ring. Like, he's too old. He shouldn't be fighting. He can't be fighting. And I love that they made Jonathan Majors' character, Dame, older. Like, so it's like, you're two old guys. So it's not like where Rocky is in Rocky VI is fighting like a young guy. It's like, well, I want to, like, the EA game told me I could beat Rocky, so I got to fight Rocky. It's like, come on. like, I at least believe this fight. And I kind of like that.
I've spoken before about my love of the film Warrior, which actually hits a lot of similar.
Yes.
One of my all-time favorite. It's one of my favorite films. It's definitely one of my favorite sports films. But it has a lot of similar machinations of actual brothers in that, but the idea of using this structure and this as like an inroads to emotions. So obviously that is something in this I was prone to. We spoke a little about Michael B. Jordan's direction in this, and a lot, Paul, I'm glad you mentioned the anime element, because a lot of press in our world got put on that in terms of how it's blocked and shot. What did you think overall of his handling of this? This is obviously an interesting way into a film when you have already been playing that character for a couple of movies.
Yeah, to me, I felt like this is the most assured first-time director I've ever seen. Like, I feel like he brought it in a really interesting way. And I think what this movie did that Creed 1 and 2, not even Ryan Coogler could do this, is break the mold of Rocky. And I say that in multiple ways. Like, first of all, they changed the fight scenes, all of them, like, and gave them these interesting things. I loved, you know, now I'm not a boxer. I'm a mediocre boxing fan. I'd watch it, but it's like, but the way that they did the eyes and seeing parts of their body, and like, you start to understand, like, oh, what are they looking for? It's not just like two guys slugging each other. And then it gave the fight stakes. Like the stakes, I think sometimes with Rocky were like, can you just stay on your feet? But this like gave it, it made it poetic. It, like I think it brought home a lot more, it made it more story points than it was just two guys choreographing a great boxing scene. Although I think he choreographed good boxing scenes as well, because the scene with the other heavyweight champion, Chavez, was good. Simple and good and violent. And but I will also say that I think that maybe, and this is like, I'm coming at this going, I really like this movie and I'm not trying to find a flaw in it. I do think that maybe when you're not on screen as much, there might have been some more emotional levels they could have hit to the story that would have even apexed it a little bit more. And I think that that's a hard thing to do, to be so in front of the camera, so centrally focused, doing all this. That's why I feel like the movie actually really thrives on that beautiful shot of the kid running back down the street when he was running away from the cops coming. Like, there's so many beautiful shots, and it's really paced well, and it's great. The music is great. He breaks the music of the other Rockies. Changed, everything has changed. But I feel like that emotional thing could have been tweaked if you're just not always in front of the camera. I think that that's, as an actor, I understand that too. It's hard.
I don't think in that ending fight, he let us feel as torn as I wanted to feel about who should win.
Hmm. I wanted him to take him down. At that point, I want, like, by the time they got in that ring.
The movie was telling us to, but I never felt that way. I was
really?
Like,
oh,
Creed's
I was
got
like
all
this,
the money. He's got everything. Like, intellectually, no, I want hurt. Majors to take this. Majors
when's
doesn't
it gonna
have
be
anything.
Dame's
Why
turn?
Can't he just have this belt? Why has he got to take the belt away from him? Like, I wanted to feel really
Dame,
conflicted because all the setup was there to make me feel conflicted, but the movie didn't let me go all the way.
But there's like this other part of this stuff, which I find, this is where like Creed does have like these like little issues that can nag at me, right? Okay, well, the mom didn't let him see the letters, so that makes him not culpable. But then he's like, well, I am culpable because I didn't check in on you. But yet, he also is not 100% responsible. So that kind of like nullifies it. But I thought there was another part of the movie too with his daughter getting into a fight. Creed's
yes,
daughter
so
gets into
about
a fight.
That.
And I thought this was interesting. You know, obviously Creed is dealing with raising a deaf daughter or hearing impaired daughter. And I love the way they handled that. I think they did a really good job of like making that part of the world and doing that in the best possible way. But like at one point, the fight between Tessa Thompson and him is like, well, you can't solve everything with your fists. And he's like, sometimes you can. And the end of the movie is like, yeah, you have to solve it with your fists. And that to me was an interesting thing. It's like, that's the takeaway for the dog.
Exactly, because they set all that up, and it's clearly meant to be this thing of like, she's learning this from you, Dad, because you're not dealing with your past. You're not ever expressing your feelings. You're just punching the crap out of people. And so at the beginning, she punches a classmate who had it coming, but you think there's going to be some emotional arc where she and the dad both learn to work through their feelings. No, the end of the movie, if anything, is setting us up for a movie 10 years from now about Amara Creed becoming like the women's heavyweight champion. I'm like, what happened to that plot point?
And I kind of get the sense that he and Tessa Thompson don't have the greatest marriage at some point, because they don't talk about any. She's like, please talk to me, and he's like, no. That's kind of it. It's like he treats out some things.
Her conversations of you need to be more forthcoming are first year of dating conversations. I was like, oh, you people have like a 7-year-old and an $8 billion house. Like this, I feel you should have covered this combo earlier.
I'll just say one other thing about like the supporting cast as well. Like, I thought the daughter was really good. I really liked. I really like his relationship with Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan. I think that that's actually where he, to me, had the most emotional punch. And those scenes felt realized. And yes, I agree with you. Like, they're a little bit basic on the, oh, you haven't talked about this yet. But at the same time, I believe them together. Like, I believe like they fought like a real couple. It didn't feel like movie couple. Yeah, contrivance, yes. So that, but I mean,
I agree with you that the relationship with Tessa unlocks a lot with him, and she's fantastic. And I also do think they integrated both her increasing hearing loss of hearing.
Yes.
And just having a deaf child and what that means. And this is a family who's learned ASL and that they did all that. And I was also grateful that they didn't turn any of those into like teachable moments.
Yes.
Or like, oh, our daughter has to forthcome. They're like, no, our daughter gets in fights. Like, good for
can
you.
Can I ask one?
Good for
can
you.
I ask one question? Sure. Okay. Did you feel like they were trying to make Wood Harris stand in for Rocky? Like I felt like they really,
absolutely.
Like I felt like there was a version of this movie where they definitely asked Stallone, will you come in? Because it's like, in my mind, they definitely asked him to come in to be at that hangar facility. Like that's about the right time where Stallone would come in and
gotta give that him dialogue his motivation.
Yeah. And I felt like, and look, I like Wood Harris. I like Wood Harris through everything, but it's also like the reason why he loses in Creed 2 is because Wood Harris doesn't have that. And that's what you see the difference is. It's like Rocky's emotionally motivating him. Wood Harris doesn't care that much. So Wood Harris has to kind of do an interesting thing because I think Wood Harris didn't mesh with Michael B. Jordan, but they had to kind of be like, hey, now you do. Now you do. Now you're going to say some stuff that kind of, it was just like, I just felt like it was a little bit, you could see the edges of if Stallone said yes.
Which brings us back to the room.
I also think Stallone should have shown up at the Felicia Rashad's funeral.
Yes, fair point.
That's all.
Fair point.
That's where I
would have also also been a nice touch. If they ever redo this on green screen, they can add that in. Okay, so how we close things out and vote on this show is if you love something with all of your heart, you are a screen it. If you are a yes, and you are a stream it, and then a skip it is sort of self-explanatory.
Of course, yes.
I'm a stream it plus. You know, like I'd say there are some cinematic elements that I think do reflect on the idea of seeing this on the big screen. I think that Jordan has some interesting choices about how to stage those fights, as we discussed, particularly the last fight. This did leave me a little bit disappointed in terms of, like I said, not really closing the loop on the daughter's emotional growth and the idea that the Dame just to me felt more conceptual than a character, despite how great Jonathan Majors is. But yeah, I would say screaming it.
You were very eloquently say that. Good.
Well, then in that spirit, I'm going to be a screen it minus. Because I want everybody to see Jonathan Majors' performance. And what I want to see is whatever they cut out of him. My dark theory is that Michael B. Jordan was like, this is a fight also between me and him as actors. He's stealing my movie away from me. And I just feel like his heel turn, it's missing two beats. I want to see him enjoy his fame. I want one more scene where I get to care about him. I feel like Michael B. Jordan took it away from me. I don't know. No proof at all. Don't sue me. But that's what I think happened. But Jonathan Majors... absolutely ferocious. So for that.
Also had the best tux at the Oscars last night.
Oh, so
great
good.
Tux.
So good. Oh, him and Brian Tyree Henry with those little white spangles. Mm.
Yeah.
What I'll say is this. I would say screen it. I'm not going to put any caveats on it besides saying it's great to see a great looking big budget drama that's also got mass appeal. Like, I just feel like, you know, we are coming back into this age where I know Owen Gleiberman wrote this article about, you know, our mediocre movies saving cinema, but what is just about solid, good films? Like, this is like really fun. It has great dramatic scenes. It's more of a drama than I thought it was going to be, actually. It's less of a boxing movie in many ways. And it's really a great story. I'm more for the proliferation of these. So I'm saying screen it. Like, let's get back to the theater and just enjoy something that doesn't have to be a full-blown spectacle for us to be there.
I'm also a screen it. This one, I loved the heavier drama angle of it. Obviously, that is more my jam than boxing in general. Not to, you know, spoiler anything about me as a human, but I really thought it was thoughtful and engaged, which is particularly meaningful with how deep this franchise is. Good for them. We're continuing to give new life to it. So we will be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Do you all know know where else to carry three beef and dairy all day.
Max Fun Drive. Hey, chef, we got another one.
Another Max Fun Drive. People know it's the best time to support the shows they love. You tell them how Meetup Day is back?
Sure did. They wanted to know about the live streams, though.
Those are finishing up right now. We can even send one out on the first night, March 20th.
March 20th, chef!
I'll give them a heads up. They also wanted the limited time thank you gifts for new and upgrading members.
Yep, and we got some fresh episodes ready to go too.
Hot stuff coming.
All right, we got exciting live streams, Meetup Day, fresh episodes, limited time gifts. Oh, and BOCO.
Yeah, okay, let them know that Max Fun Drive 2023 will be ready on March 20th, and it'll only be 2 weeks.
2 weeks, chef!
Max Fun Drive starts on March 20th for just 2 weeks. No problem.
Order up!
Shoot, I forgot their water.
And now, a live reading from Rachel's Poetry Corner.
Elephants Theremin's Clifton, Neopets Porstrips Jepson, Pine Smell Jellybeans Goligoles, Skittles Squirrels and the Mole, Celery Chopsticks Pumpernickel, A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, Lullabies Tie-Dye The More You Know, all of these things on our wonderful show.
All these things and more wait for you on Wonderful every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I am still Drea Clark, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Amy Nicholson.
And Paul Scheer.
Okay, and producer Marissa popping in with the quiz, as all the kids want. She's quiz crazy.
Hello, everybody. I am quiz crazy, and I hope you guys are quiz crazy, too. That's hard to say.
If he's like, how dare you do one without me? But
oh, man, I'm sure if he wants to be in a room with the four of you doing a movie trivia quiz, which actually it does have some bearing on this quiz. So I wanted to write a movie quiz about actor-directors, since this is Michael B. Jordan's directorial debut. He stars in the movie, and lots of actors have done that over the years, right? Made the switch from being actors, even movie stars, to directors. But, you know, as I started looking at what are these options, I was like, this is going to be way too easy for you four people. Like, maybe the average civilian might be struggling, but you four are going to know right away. So I thought I would complicate it just a tiny bit in a game I'm calling Single, Double, or Triple Threat. So I'm going to tell you the name of a movie that is a director's debut film, an actor director's debut, directorial debut.
Okay.
And you tell me whether they just directed the movie.
Oh, no.
Directed and starred in the movie, or directed, starred, and wrote the movie. Now, star, actually, I mean, acted in any capacity in the film.
Appeared,
and some of these are co-credits with writing or directing. So if you want to say single, double, triple, really lean into the game, you can. And I think we just shout the answers for this one, because you guys are going to know some of them real quick.
So when I accidentally shout Drea, you'll know what I meant was. Yeah.
You can also shout Drea to answer, to buzz in.
We always accept that.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with one that might be a little bit harder than I initially thought when I chose this director. Nights and Weekends.
Triple. Co-directed, co-written, and starring Greta Gerwig.
That's right. Jesus. Alonzo doing all the mental math right at the same time. Yeah, it was the Mumblecore movie with Joe Swanberg before her follow-up, which was?
Lady Bird.
No,
Lady Bird.
And I was like, Nights and Weekend. That's like French New Wave. What
I know.
Are
they?
I was thinking of Night and Day with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. Like,
when are we not thinking of
You are nothing
Day.
If not on brand.
Yeah.
All right. How about One Night in Miami?
That is two.
Single? Is and she just directed, didn't she?
Single Thread, I want to say.
And she is?
Oh, Regina King.
Regina King. All right. You guys can start by saying the name of the director. Just for anybody listening at home that has no idea.
Gotcha.
You are supposed to say that. I wasn't clear, but I think some of the listeners maybe won't know quite as much about all these movies as you guys do. How about Play Misty for Me?
Double. Clint Eastwood directed and starred, but didn't write?
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
I have such a fondness for this movie, but it wasn't until researching this that I realized that one of his co-stars is Jessica Walter in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because at the time I saw the movie in college, I didn't know who Jessica Walter was yet. This is like pre-Arrested Development. And I was a teenager. Cut me some slack.
I am terrible on Twitter, but one of the only Twitter moments I ever had with any note was when he died. I posted a GIF of Jessica Walter stabbing him.
Wait, who died?
Or no, when she died, I posted a picture.
Fitties would have still with us.
A girl can dream. A girl can dream. First, folks.
Yeah. We'll
get there. All right.
Yeah, sorry if you hadn't heard about Clint yet.
Okay, let's hope nothing happens during the course of this week, man. Okay. Mid-90s.
Single.
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 Yeah.
Jonah Hill single?
Oh, double. Did he write
it? It is a double. It's Jonah Hill, and he also wrote it.
Wrote and directed. Okay.
Cool. Jojo Dancer, Your All Life three. Is Calling.
Triple.
Yeah, Paul and Alonzo, you got it. And the director is
Richard Pryor.
How about Pitch Perfect 2?
Double. Elizabeth Banks.
Elizabeth Banks. Yep. Sorry.
That's right. And which are the two things that she wrote?
She wrote and
directed. Directed and starred.
Oh, no, she directed.
Yeah,
directed and starred. She was in it, right? As one of the judges, right?
Yes. With John Michael Higgins.
How about The Gift?
Oh, I can see this movie.
A sort of like thriller.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't remember.
Wait, it's Triple and it's Joel Edgerton.
All three.
Oh, that one. I was thinking of some Keanu Reeves.
There's a Sam Raimi movie called The Gift which I always get this.
Oh, the Joel Edgerton one. Yep. Is great.
Yeah,
good for him. Jason Bateman.
Pretty good little thriller.
Yeah.
Right. I was picturing Jason Bateman. My friend Rebecca produced it.
Rebecca Hall? Is that Rebecca Hall in that one? Yeah. What a cast.
She's all not right. My friend Rebecca that produced it. Different Rebecca.
Yeah. That Thing You Do.
Double.
Is he in it? Yeah.
Dom Hanks directed it and is a co-star, but didn't
he also wrote it?
He also wrote it.
Wrote that one. If you want to listen to Tom Hanks being interviewed on Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, you can hear him talk a little bit about writing That Thing You Do. How about Reality Bites?
Triple.
No, double. Double. He did not
write it. It's a different writer. That's right.
Ben Stiller starred in and directed. Nice.
I love that movie so much.
I think an unusual one, right? He'd usually be a writer.
And the woman who wrote it. Like, never did anything else.
She never had to.
That's so Gen X.
Never had to.
She did it just fine.
Yes. Melrose Place is a really great show. Yeah.
At the end is naive backwards.
Well, we can wrap up in a moment here, but I'll just give you a couple more of the...
I really hope you ask the one I'm prepared for. There's one I'm so prepared for, and I really hope it comes up.
In the Land of Blood and Honey.
Oh, all three.
Single.
Oh, shit.
Angelina Jolie directed, but is not in it, and I want to say also didn't write it?
She actually did write it.
Oh, I thought this is the Winnie the Pooh movie.
Blood and Honey are both Winnie the Pooh. Yes, Blood and Honey is a sequel to In the Land of Blood and Honey, I think. I don't know. I wish I could know which one you were ready for. How about Booksmart?
Booksmart is a double?
Single? Double? Is it a single for Olivia Wilde? Is she in it?
No, I thought she's
like an Uber driver or something.
Oh, she's an Uber driver?
No, she's Triple.
Oh. Or no, Jason Sudeikis,
Sudeikis is in it. But Olivia Wilde is not in it.
According to IMDb. Oh, I thought she co-wrote it.
So single?
She's a single, right? Yeah.
Oh,
single.
Wow, okay.
Yep. And Little Man Tate.
Oh, Jodie Foster. That's a double.
Double?
No. It's a double, yeah.
Directed and starred.
All right. Yeah. I have a few more on this list, but I think we are at time
here. What were you waiting for, Amy? I was waiting for quick change.
Dog.
Oh!
I love Dog. Did nobody else see Dog? A triple for Channing Tatum?
Oh, I love Dog so much. I didn't remember that he even directed Dog.
Co-directed. Well,
as listeners know by now, these quizzes are often hastily researched, so I didn't...
This was a really good one, so...
Thank you. A round of applause
for producer Marissa.
Well, well done, all of you. Just as amazing at this trivia game as I knew you would be. And I'll hand it back to you, Drea.
All right. I will accept your handing. Okay, now it is time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all through history and time. Just needs to be a movie. Who would like to go first?
So I'm going to circle this back to our Oscar chat from the top of the episode. I'm so thrilled that Michelle Yeoh is now an Oscar-winning actress. She has been putting in the work, as they say, for decades. And right now on Criterion Channel, there's a whole section called Michelle Yeoh Kicks Ass, where they have, I want to say, like 8 of her films that you should have seen by now. I'm going to say start with a couple from the early 90s, The Heroic Trio, which is a fun kind of superhero movie, and then also Police Story 3 Super Cop, which is a comedy action movie that teams her with Jackie Chan. She plays a no-nonsense Chinese police woman, and Jackie Chan is a Hong Kong representative, and the two of them team up to take down bad guys, and they're a lot of fun together. She's dynamite, and so, you know, if you are maybe new to her or only knew her from like that Bond movie and Crouching Tiger, this is a great way to catch up on some of her really wonderful early work.
We did a full episode actually on Police Story 3 Super Cop a couple of months ago. Just nice. In salute of her. She's fantastic.
Nice. All right. Amy, do you have a pick?
I do. Yeah. There's this movie that I've been holding up as a template for the kind of movie I want to watch lately. And this is in part because my boyfriend and I subscribe to a lot of like the cult streaming services. This was one from Arrow. You know, Arrow does, they treat terrible movies from the 80s and 90s as though they are Criterion worthy. And so we watched a movie a couple weeks ago is the correct time span, called Death Spa. And Yay! It was just such a delight. I loved Death Spa. It's about a high-tech spa here in LA in the 80s where like all the gym equipment is like super like Siri, Siri-ish, Siri-operated. And then it starts killing people. And it's just the greatest schlock I've seen in a while. It just really hit it. It was like such a fun premise, such a fun set. The kills were really inventive. Like nothing about this movie felt lazy. It just, it hit exactly right. Exactly right. And so Death Spa is now like my gold standard for schlocky 80s
well,
murder
Amy,
movie, which is really
I'll
hard to
you,
find.
I'll tell you, we did a whole episode on that, on how did this get made. But more importantly, if you want to do a great double feature, let's talk about Death Spa and Perfect back to back. Because it's the same exact time, but a real...
Also speaking of Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, Perfect... Thanks to Perfect, that's why Jamie Lee Curtis got an Oscar. I want to shout out. Every genre movie I ever made is how I got an Oscar.
It. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll go on my double feature kick right now because suggesting that one, I'm going to suggest another one. Okay. So I'm going to put together two movies that I recently saw that I hadn't seen in a long time. And many people said to me, I can't believe you haven't seen these two movies. The first movie is Hooper. Burt Reynolds, Hooper, which is truly great. Burt Reynolds, Hooper is Burt Reynolds playing his stuntman, Hal Needham, in a movie directed by Hal Needham. So that could have gone back to our last game in a weird way. And it's a really great premise. It's the idea that, like, what happens when, you know, you are kind of aging out of that profession. And this is a time where, you know, these guys are really putting their bodies on the line. They're always are putting their bodies on the line, but even worse than now. And the new guy who comes in, Jan Michael Vincent, is going to take his place. But it's a really cool film. Great, great stunts. Really fun stunts. And an insane ending. The movie that I'm going to say that you should partner this with, and this is something I just saw about a week ago, is Stuntman. I don't know if you've ever seen Stuntman. I'm talking about the 1980 film Stuntman with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback, where Steve Railsback is a guy escaping from prison who then winds up becoming a stand-in slash double for another actor who died on set, but they don't want to tell anyone he died on set because then the movie would shut down, so he just basically has to do all the stunts. Again, it's an insane film. It's such a bizarre movie where this guy takes over somebody else's life but then finds worth in his own life. Really interesting movie. But back to back, if you want to watch movies on stuntmen, The Stuntman, 1980, and also Hooper.
And I believe in the Max Fun Boco, you can hear Dre and me talk about Hooper with Jordan and Jesse. So
yep. We sure did. Hooper, fantastic. Sally Field's in it. And also, if you're like worried that this film about stuntmen does not have enough footage of a horse circling a pen in moonlight, fear not. It sure does. Okay, my staff pick, I have already suggested the film Warrior, the Gavin O'Connor aforementioned, that has Joel Edgerton in it and Tom Hardy. I've spent my staff pick in the past, so instead I'm going to leapfrog off of Paul mentioning in Rocky III how Burt Young had that, there's like this robot, like this is stupid, and I'm going to counter program and offer up Robot and Frank, which was a film from 2012 by Jake Schreier, and it stars Frank Langella, who is wonderful and aging, and his family has, he's an ex-con and a thief, and he is dealing with dementia, and so his family gets him this like care robot, and he and the robot decide to pull a heist. But it actually has, it's not like After Yang levels of introspection, but it does detail some of the ideas of what sort of care looks like in the elderly, and technology being utilized for that. So Robot and Frank, that's my counter programming pick for today. Thank you all. Paul and Amy, so delightful to have you both back.
This together is, on yes, the show.
Obviously, presumably, anyone who listens to our show is a movie fan, and you should definitely be listening to Unspooled, where you guys work your way through a ton of classic films. Can you speak about where people can find you and your work and support and listen and everything else?
Well, you can find Unspooled wherever you listen to your podcasts. And yeah, and like we did start off doing very much like the AFI top 100 list, but we've now gotten into just like what makes a classic film. Is Magic Mike a classic film? You know, is Creed a classic film? Like, what are the new classics? So we kind of go back and forth between some very, very like established classics, but we also are kind of bringing in what, you know, anything that's 10 years and older that still has staying power. Like, why? And or is it worth all the acclaim that it got? Like, where will Coda be in 10 years? We'll find out. We'll talk about it. But that you can listen wherever you get your stuff. And then on social media, I'm just Paul Scheer, S-C-H-E-E-R.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And on social media, I am the Amy Nicholson, although I'm really only on Instagram nowadays. I just can't bear to log into Twitter. Oh well. But life soldiers on. And yeah, we are just having a ton of fun doing random wonderful movies on the show. It's always like a really interesting conversation. The eclecticness is what I love about it.
Excellent. I've loved the dovetail from the top 100 as well. A fun trajectory. I used the word trajectory twice today. Feeling good about that. Can't wait till my dad texts me about my limited vocabulary. Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show and your beautiful books in the background, which fuel my whole week. Next week, we will be kicking off the Max Fun Drive. Woo! That we're required to do the woos, and I'm glad Alonzo chimed in when he was meant to. We are starting with the 1968 kaiju movie, Destroy All Monsters, joined by possibly one of our most handsome guests ever, Dave White, a.k.a. Mr. Alonzo Duralde. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/group/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our wonderful producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our delicious senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
That was so fun.
Yay!
Thank you so much. Hi, you guys. That was so fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.